Kia ora and welcome back to RDU 98.5. Well, it's time for something a little different now. He's just come out with a book called A Bloody Difficult Subject. And my gosh, he does prove it's not an easy subject, that's for sure. I have author Bain Attwood on the line with me now. Good morning, Bain.
Good morning, Liam.
How are you?
Very well, thanks. And you?
I'm very well, thank you. First of all, hey, congratulations for having this book out. It's a fascinating, fascinating read, but I think I won't do it justice probably kind of trying to explain this book. So to start off with, I was just wondering, could you... just for our audience, explain this book a little bit.
Thank you. Well, this is a book which focuses, first of all, on one historian, one Papua historian by the name of Ruth Ross, and her path-breaking work on the treaty, or what she called Te Tiriti, which she begins in the early to mid-1950s. And what I go on to point out in the book is that the way that most New Zealanders, both Māori and Pākehā, understand the treaty today owes an enormous amount to a journal article that Ruth Ross published in 1972, an article she published in the New Zealand Journal of History. Now, that was an academic journal, and usually academic journal articles, whether they're by historians or somebody else, usually are only read within the universities by teachers, by students. But her article has been read very, very widely, and it's had enormous influence. So the way we tend to understand the treaty today, that it's a treaty in two language texts, English and Māori, that there are enormous differences in the meaning of those two texts, and that the text in Te Reo Māori is the more important. This is what Ruth Ross argued, not only in her article that I mentioned, it published in 1972, but she was arguing this as early as the mid-1950s. And so I trace how she came to write that article or do this work in the early to mid-1950s and then again in the early 1970s. It's unprecedented. I mean, when she starts doing this work, yes, it's known that the treaty is in two texts, the English and the Māori, but even the great Māori leader Aparana Nata still thought that the English version was the more important. It was often referred to as the official version of the treaty. And not much attention is paid to what Ruth Ross argued was the differences between the two texts, let alone argue that the Māori text was the more important. So the work she does in the mid-1950s, and which she really makes known, fully known in 1972, it's unprecedented. So the first part of the book is really telling that story about the authorship of her, what really becomes this famous 1972 article. Then it moves on to try and understand why and how her article was influential. And the important moment in the story I tell is really the early to mid-1980s. By this time, sadly, Ruth Ross has passed away. She's born 1920. She dies relatively young, the age of 62. And in 1983, the Waitangi Tribunal, under the brilliant leadership of Eddie Jury, it takes up her work and interprets it in a particular way. And what I try and unravel in my book is the way in which this important article of her really goes in quite different directions, has at least two different threads which cast the treaty in really radically different lights. On the one hand, in this article, she contends that the English text was poorly translated into Māori, and as a consequence, she contends, the Māori text meant very different to what the English text said. And she argues that that means that the treaty is ambiguous, that this historic agreement of 1840 is contradictory. And so she argues that the signatories to the treaty, namely the Māori Rangatira and the representatives of the British Crown, she argues that they cannot possibly have a common meaning. And this for her is part of really an attack she makes on the treaty, or the treaty status as the New Zealand's Magna Carta. She's scathing of this notion that it can be the basis of a sacred covenant, let alone a legal contract. So that's, in my view, her major argument. But there's no doubt that if her article is read in a particular way, you can understand it to be saying something else. What I said before, that the two versions of the treaty are very different, and that the Māori text is the more authoritative. And she argues that it's the more authoritative because she points out that of the 540 rangatira who signed the treaty in 1840 across New Zealand, 500 of the 540 put their signatures or marks on a version, the version in Māori, and only 40 sign the English one. And so on that basis, she argues the Māori text is more important. Anyway, in 1983, Eddie Jury, chairing the Waitangi Tribunal, he begins, if you like, a process where he's not really interested in what I've called her major argument, that the treaty is ambiguous and contradictory and can never be the basis of a legal contract. He, as a lawyer, begins reading or interpreting her article to be saying this other thing, that two texts different meaning, but the Māori text is more authoritative. And so I trace that story, and then I go on in the third part of the book to be really raising these questions of how we interpret the treaty, how this has changed enormously across the last 50 or not 70 years, and then to the point where we might say we are at today, where there's enormous emphasis on Māori and Pākehā having different ways of knowing the past, different ways of knowing the world, and this question of how do you negotiate really two different ways of knowing, and how which often are coming into conflict. And these are, I think, really important questions in any democracy.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting point to make, as you illustrate quite clearly, you know, how far our understanding of the treaty has come. One thing I want to ask, though, is, yeah, Ruth Roth seems like a fascinating, fascinating character, and she has such incredible reverence and interest in documenting Māori culture and getting, you know, their side of the story, essentially. Why is it that she isn't really a household name?
Well, I guess part of the story here is to do with gender, that she's a woman at a time in New Zealand where, what would we say, that men well and truly ruled the roost.
Mm.
She was lucky in the sense that she was able to go to university, she got an academic training in the discipline of history, beginning in the late 1930s, he was then able to work as a historian. That she had a very powerful mentor, teacher, patron in the form of J.C. Beaglehole, best known as the great scholar of James Cook. So she has that support, and Beaglehole, in some sense, was very supportive of Ruth Ross and a number of other brilliant women students. In the late 1930s and early 1940s. But whereas he encouraged his men students to go off to Oxford and Cambridge, which is what you did in those days if you wanted to go and, you know, do advanced studies, but none of the he never encouraged any of the women. And there's a way in which she's something of an outsider. Now, there's a very famous book published a long time ago, 1962, by a philosopher by the name of Thomas Kuhn, called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. He's best known, I suppose, for formulating a phrase or a notion of a paradigm shift. And this is really what Ruth Ross does. He brings about this paradigm shift. And Thomas Kuhn makes the point in this book that it's often those on the margins or the outsiders who are responsible for paradigm shifts, rather than those who are, you know right at the center of what's going on. And
yeah,
Ruth
right.
Ross is very much this outsider. And in terms of what you said before, that she becomes very interested in trying to understand Māori perspectives of the world, and particularly the treaty, there's a crucial moment, which I relate in the book, where in 1955, she and her husband and the two young children move from Auckland. And I think this is really, she's driving this rather than her husband, although it's her husband who's appointed to a position in the Māori school system. He's appointed to the position of a teacher in the far north, in Hokianga. So they moved there, as I said, in 1955. And you know, it's a remote place, and it's very much a Māori community. Almost all the children in the school and almost all the people in this small community are Māori. And Ruth Ross hears Māori being spoken around her. She doesn't speak Māori. She reads it a little bit.
Mm.
And she teaches for a short period of time in the school. And she's teaching young Māori boys and girls whose first language is Māori. And she encounters really a problem which is at the heart of her work, which is this question of translating. How do you translate the English text into Māori, the problems of the two peoples understanding one another? She, in a sense, encounters this in this community. And there's, a crucial moment where one day she asks two Māori men, who she calls rangatira, to sit down with her, so to speak, and look at the text of the treaty that was not only signed at Waitangi, but at Manunu Mission, which was just up the road from where they were living. And there's this moment where they enter into this conversation about what as far as these Māori men are concerned, what does the Treaty of Te Tiriti mean to them? And so she's unusual at that time. There's not many Pākehā, Pākehā trained academic historians who are interested in this. And you know, a year later, 1956, she goes down from Hokianga to Wellington to do some more research, and she presents a paper to a historical association, which basically comprises of staff and students at what became Victoria University. And she presents this argument where she's focusing on the Māori text, and she's told that her work is historically worthless. So at this time, academic historians, they're not that much interested in the treaty, and they certainly don't seem much interested in the Māori text.
Mm.
And then, you know, 15 years later, she's actually invited back really by the same people invited her to speak in 1956. She's 15 years later, she's invited back, and she's told that she's the one that they most want to hear from. And she says, well, fashions change. And that's part of the point I'm making, is that our present changes, so too does the way we see the past, and that includes how we understand and interpret the treaty.
Yeah, that's a really fascinating point. You've done such a reverence of understanding Ruth Ross quite well. Do you feel like you know her now?
Yes, I do. I mean, she left when she passed away. She left this extraordinary archive. It runs to something like 90 boxes.
Wow.
Folders in these boxes. And the most important part of this collection, as far as I'm concerned, is thousands and thousands of letters. Now, she wasn't unusual as far as New Zealanders go, of her generation, particularly New Zealand Pākehā women, in that she wrote letters regularly. She had a large number of correspondents. She was unusual, though, in that she kept copies of most of the letters she received, and more importantly, from my point of view, the letters she wrote. So quite early in her career as a historian, and she was always juggling her work of being a historian with her family responsibilities, but she was encouraged to make carbon copies of her letters, and she typed most of her letters, and so that makes it easier for us to read today. Mm. And so I was able to get a very good sense of her, because it's not only that she wrote thousands of letters, but in my view, she wrote her letters as though she was talking to the addressee or her interlocutor.
Right, right.
As though they were in the room and she was talking to them. So they reveal a great deal, and they're very lively letters. Now, her academic, her historical writing is like most academic historians. It's somewhat dull, but her letters sparkle. And in calling the book, perhaps I should explain why I've called the book A Bloody Difficult Subject. In 1972, when she's preparing what becomes this famous article for the New Zealand Journal of History, she writes in a letter to Keith Sinclair, one of the most important Pākehā historians in the post-war period, and he's the editor of this journal. And she writes to him saying, at one point, referring to the treaty, it's a bloody difficult subject. But Ruth Ross herself could be bloody difficult. She, on her own admission, she could be bloody difficult. And also, I mean, this reference by her to the treaty being bloody difficult, it's not the first time she's, by any means, that she swears in her letters. And, you know, for a middle-class woman of her generation, she was unusual. She,
she swore a great deal.
And so she's a bloody difficult subject. She thought the treaty was bloody difficult, but also trying to write history, I mean, and trying to negotiate these different understandings that we all have, probably, of really important texts and important events like the making of the treaty. That also, in my view, is to follow Ruth Ross, bloody difficult. But it's really crucial. It's really important.
We
do this in New Zealand.
Yeah, well, I you've just done such a fascinating job here. And, Bain, honestly, I could talk to you all day. I have so many questions. But time is not of the essence. But I do want to say thank you so very much for joining me this morning. Where can people pick up your book?
Well, it's published by Auckland University Press. So one way is through the Auckland University Press website.
Mm-hmm.
But the book was released just yesterday. And so, as the saying goes, in all good New Zealand bookshops.
Brilliant. Bain, thank you so very much for joining me this morning. Have a wonderful, wonderful day.
Thanks very much, Liam. I really enjoyed the conversation.
And that was Bain Attwood, publisher of the author, I should say, of the new book, A Bloody Difficult Subject. And just trust me when I say this book is fascinating. Even if it's not kind of your usual content absorption, I really encourage you to read this. It is just so, so interesting.